One Mind for Research campaign, Garen Staglin.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. That was a short 5 minutes, wasn't it? That's a watchword for how we're going to run the rest of the conference here this morning. So good morning to all of you, and what a great day it is. This was just an idea about 10 months ago, and here we are today to celebrate the launch of the One Mind campaign. On behalf of my co-chair, Patrick Kennedy, we want to welcome you all. We meet today for one purpose and one alone, to accelerate, in the moonshot analogy, to the speed of spaceflight, our research progress to find cures and treatments for diseases of the brain. Our premise is simple. If our brains are capable of figuring out how to send a spaceship 250,000 miles away and back, we must have the capacity to look inside our brains, understand what we see, and learn how to fix what goes wrong. Before I share my opening comments, a few thank yous are in order. I'm going to introduce Steve Hyman shortly, so I'll save his for later. And also, just to remind you, please put your cell phones on silent if you haven't already done so. First, the Society for Neuroscience has provided incredible support in preparation for this conference and for the creation of the 10-year plan. In particular, I want to thank Susan Amara, who's here, head of the Society for Neuroscience, and Marty Sagacy, and the entire Society for Neuroscience organization. Thank you very much. The Dana Foundation was an early endorser of the One Mind campaign and is providing complete videography and website editions of the proceeding this week. And those will be up and available on the onemindforresearch.org website very shortly after this conference. And I heard some distinguished professors here saying that they may no longer have to teach now. They'll just show this video as we go forward here. But in any event, we thank Ed Rover and Barbara Gill for making this happen. And a great hand in communication to the advocacy community was facilitated by the American Brain Coalition. Many of their members are here today, and we want to thank Katie Sally and Allison Kupferman for making that happen. And finally, many others have contributed in so many ways that it would be impossible for to list them all, but let me just single out Liz Page and Amanda Hartless of Liz Page Associates, as well as John Sack and Cindy Dyer of IMRO for their total dedication to the details of this amazing 3-day event. So the coming days will be devoted in many ways to science. You'll hear facts and figures. You'll see imagery that captures the imagination and dazzles it. And you'll share knowledge and discuss research. But what's on my mind as we launch this journey is personal, as I'm guessing it may be for many of you in this room. I want to tell you about our son, Brandon, who's here with us today, and along with my wife, Sherry, and our personal journey, a journey that makes this conference more about hope for our loved ones than about the science itself. Sherry and I were in Paris when we first got the call. Brandon had been hospitalized with symptoms that were eventually diagnosed as schizophrenia. In the coming years, we saw him struggle, burdened by his symptoms, but even more than that, plagued by stigma. Stigma that makes it difficult for him to lead the college life of others and dissuaded him from discussing his condition. Stigma, even though his symptoms were produced by chemical misfires in his brain, no different from any physiological abnormality in any other disease. Stigma, even though he bears no more responsibility for his illness than a patient with cancer or any other affliction. So I know the barrier we must overcome to reach this goal we have set for ourselves in the next few days and beyond is not merely lack of knowledge, but also bias. Not just lack of adequate science, but stigma. And let's be clear, not just stigma, but silos. For discrimination is only one attitude among many we must overcome. Many of the attitudes that impede our success are, in fact, our own. We must overcome the perspective of neuroscience as a collection of isolated, disease-centric specialties. We must change our interest from protecting discoveries in our own individual labs to global collaboration to benefit each other's success and failures and accelerate our progress. And we must overcome the delusion that gradual progress is enough, the false belief that measured pace of science is beyond our ability to accelerate. We must break our attachment to science for science's sake. For what matters, and from my perspective, all that matters, is not how many papers we publish, but how many people we heal, and how many lives we improve, and how quickly we do it. In these respects, we stand here today on the cusp of scientific history. The One Mind Conference represents an opportunity to create for the first time a total and integrated community of neuroscience and advocates to accelerate from gradual science to emergency science, to unite isolated approaches into a coordinated campaign, the One Mind Campaign. So I urge you to embrace these next few days not as passive consumers of information, but as active participants in getting and generating and sharing this progress. I urge you to reject modest goals and cautious timeframes. I urge you, above all, to believe in what we and in what you have the power to achieve. This we do for the 100 million Americans with brain diseases. This Sherry and I do for Brandon. This we all must do, for it's within our power to see cures, to see a total understanding of the workings of the human brain within our lifetimes. And because 60 is the new 40, I'm counting on this. We need many things. We need to complete our research. We need to secure funding. We need to find breakthroughs. But most of all, we need to be what we are here today. We need to be of one mind to succeed. Thank you. It's my pleasure now to introduce Steve Hyman, Provost of Harvard and former Director of the National Institute of Mental Health. Steve has a resume that is so complete that it would take me a couple of years to read it. And no doubt everybody in this room has either worked with or for him in some capacity or another. His unique combination of scientific and administrative management skills combines with a finely tuned ability to manage complex processes and, oh, by the way, egos, to make him the one and only choice to head our Scientific Development Council. We can't thank him enough for his leadership in the development of the 10-year roadmap. He has juggled his incredibly busy schedule, the week of commencement and trustee meetings at Harvard, to be with us this morning to present the summary vision of the One Mind for Research roadmap. Please welcome Steve Hyman.
Well, good morning, everybody. We'll get serious in just 1 minute, but before a few of my own thank yous, you might wonder how I got into this. So I went to San Diego for the neuroscience meetings, hoping to catch some sun. Like most East Coast provosts, I normally have looked like I've been under fluorescent lights for a long time. And I was walking along when all of a sudden, Garen and Patrick Kennedy dropped out of a palm tree and landed on me. And as I recovered, it's all about the brain. As I became reoriented, I found out that I was doing this, whatever this was. And so this goes to the thanks. I think that this is a really important effort. It is very important at a time when so many of our colleagues in many scientific disciplines are checking their bodies and their wallets for wounds. They are in retrenchment mode. As a university provost, I am professionally frightened and looking at everybody's funding projections. And instead, here we are planning a major push into neuroscience. Instead of retrenching, we are thinking of new and better ways of doing things. And with the leadership of Garen Staglin and Patrick Kennedy, we are going to try to convince various government agencies outside the NIH and private philanthropy and industry that this is the time to fund neuroscience. I also want to thank very much the Society for Neuroscience, especially Marty Segassi, who seems always to be online. I would send him email sometime after midnight on random weekdays and have an answer before I logged off. And unsung hero Liz Rumsey, who tried to schedule, and many of you said, I am free for, 9 seconds, somehow here you all are. And I want to thank the Dana Foundation and Ed Rover for all they have done to produce the summary booklet that you have and to edit the plan that's on the web and to generally support this effort, and especially Barbara Gill and then Barbara Rich, who again was up in the wee hours editing my gargoyled and really awful prose as I got more and more tired and was writing from hypnagogic states. And I really thank them enormously. Okay, now to the serious bit. This is an overview that it will parallel very much what you have in the pamphlet, which is a pamphlet not necessarily only meant for this choir, but is meant, as you go door to door ringing the bell and converting people to neuroscience. There is a long version of a 10-year plan that is on the web. And let me just say, this plan was assembled beginning in December of this past year, very, very quickly. None of us believe that it is perfect. On the other hand, having it on the website in public view will allow us a process of refining the plan. And if you read in the booklet, everybody is involved, is very sophisticated about the balance between basic science and translational and clinical science. And as you'll see, nobody is planning some Orwellian takeover of neuroscience or the Soviet state, but rather, I think, a rather clever and engaging and motivating push for neuroscience that, as Garen says, is going to take discoveries, or must take discoveries, much more rapidly from the lab into the clinic. So the goals, can I control the slides from up here? Let's see. Yes. So the goals underlying this program are pretty straightforward. We want to make the case for strong funding of neuroscience despite fiscally challenging times. Part of what we need to do is to diminish the fragmentation in planning. Now, let me talk about that for a second. None of us thinks that a single voice can speak for all of the various parts of neuroscience. But historically, for example, even in the NIH, instead of having, a single brain institute like the National Cancer Institute, we have five institutes that are very much dedicated at their core to neuroscience, but 13 or 14 overall supporting neuroscience. And this means that when large infrastructure, shared databases, perhaps large clinical trials are needed, it is much more difficult in neuroscience to get to pull that off than it is in cancer or cardiology. This is a contingent historical accident. Now, right now, we happen to be fortunate to have NIH Institute directors who have been engaged in this process, have worked very hard, and who are very collaborative. But they are embedded in an institutional design with councils and supporters that make it harder for them to collaborate than you would sometimes imagine. In addition, the VA and the Department of Defense also support neuroscience research. And in my memories from my time in Washington and my recent refresher course with Garen and Patrick Kennedy, I realized just how siloed those agencies are and how much work we're going to have to do to avoid, not only to avoid unnecessary duplication, but to unleash collaborative, creative advances. And this is just one example of the kind of fragmentation that sometimes impedes what we want to get done. I want to highlight investments in tool building, shared large-scale databases, and collaborative networks. And now again, for the basic scientist in a small lab pursuing hypothesis-driven research, the goal is not to crowd out that traditional approach to science, but to make it stronger by allowing people to rely on publicly available data and on tools. If you look in the larger version of the plan on the web, there is, for the scientists, a fairly technical but compelling section on microscopy, which has remarkably increased our capacity to make advances in neuroscience. And this would not be possible without collaborations with chemists and physicists and engineers and all kinds of other people building these exciting new tools that then free us to answer biological questions. The problem being, and the reason I want to highlight this, is that the building of tools, the maintenance of databases over time are very hard to fund in our traditional federal funding system. If you're building a tool, the question is, where's your hypothesis? Whereas I can't stress enough the importance of tools, whether it's microscopy or MRI or high-throughput chemical screening tools to our field. So this is something we really want to think about. And we also want to think about something that Garen mentioned, which is the sharing of approaches, tools, reagents, and data in a way that speeds discovery for all of us. And then finally, we have to repair the increasingly damaged ecosystem for treatment development by mitigating the risk for the biotech and pharma companies that in some frightening numbers are exiting brain science as too difficult just at the time we're about to make it easier for them. So I'll come back to that in a second. Now, for many of you, you've seen various versions of this, but for others, this bears some understanding. And sometimes among neuroscientists, your eyes glaze over when you see population data and rely on your epidemiologic friends, if you have any, to get excited. But this is really important. It really makes the case for at least the need for discovery. So what is critical is understanding disease burden. For most of history, and understandably so, health statistics focused only on causes of mortality. Okay? So neuropsychiatric disorders, neurologic disorders, have always been important contributors to mortality. Stroke, Alzheimer's disease, suicide. Suicide is, among young people, depending on the precise demography, the second or third leading cause of death, an incredible tragedy. Suicide now exceeds death in combat for our military, according to Tom Insel, the current director of the NIMH. So brain diseases kill. And sometimes, famously, the process can be terribly painful, as in some of the neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's disease, ALS. But compared to infectious disease in much of the world, cardiovascular disease, and cancer, these are, not the leading causes of death. What was important in recognizing the true and extraordinary burden of brain disorders on society was to understand the role of disease in disability. And this began with an analysis of the World Bank and the World Health Organization in the 1990s trying to help countries understand how best to invest scarce health dollars. And ultimately, they came up with a measure that is a simple sum of premature mortality and years of life lost to disability. And this sum is called the disability-adjusted life year. Now, you know, here among scientists, I will tell you that the methodology for coming up with disability weights is challenging, and the World Health Organization is looking at it again. But however one looks at it, brain disorders come out in a very important position for reasons that I'll share with you in a second. But if you just look, the leading cause of DALYs because of the disability weighting in advanced market economies like ours or Canada's are neuropsychiatric disorders. And there's external corroboration. After a bad lower back, depression alone is the leading cause of disability in all of these countries in ways that can be measured. And then among the neuropsychiatric and neurologic disorders, if you just have a sense of the compared to other individual disorders, number one cause of DALYs, so this actually integrates premature mortality, is depression. Number three is alcohol use disorders. Number seven is Alzheimer's dementia. And number eight is cerebrovascular disease. So four of the top eight causes of DALYs in the United States and Canada are brain disorders. That, leaving out even the suffering, the family disruption, the effects on caregivers, that makes a powerful case for the urgency. Now, why is the burden so great? So the answers are actually pretty straightforward and convincing. We haven't made these things up. These disorders are common. Major depression, worthy of a clinical intervention, affects 18% of Americans. I mean, I just took that one example. Many brain disorders begin early in life and affect human capital formation and thus employability. Look, we want to turn people who are dependents into taxpayers, right? But these disorders that begin early, that works better in Congress, that's all right. But disorders like autism, learning disorders, many forms of epilepsy, schizophrenia, all begin before adult life. And these are extraordinarily costly to families, to individuals, and of course, to society as a whole. And others are chronic or recurring, chronic diseases like Alzheimer's, traumatic brain injury, right? Somebody comes back from Afghanistan or Iraq at the age of 20. Bipolar disorder has a recurring course throughout the lifespan. And these disorders are disproportionately disabling because they affect the brain. We sometimes take this for granted, but we know this is the organ of cognition, of emotion, and underlies our ability to control our behavior, to have goals and pursue those goals. This is very different, as bad as it is to have an injury to a limb or to other organs, and I don't mean ever to make light or to pit one set of diseases against another. It's no surprise that these disorders are extraordinarily disabling and therefore have a disproportionate impact on society. It's just that these things are invisible, right? No one is wearing a sling or a bandage or has blood on them. And so we have to, like the Ancient Mariner, you know, keep repeating and repeating and educating and educating. And this also runs into the teeth of the stigma, the misunderstanding that Garen outlined for us just a few minutes ago. The other thing that should focus the mind here is the state of returning soldiers from our 2.2 wars, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq, and then what's ever happening in Libya. But in many ways, the signature wounds of these wars are brain wounds, right? Traumatic brain injury from the concussive force of IEDs, which above all impact circuits involving the prefrontal cortex and therefore executive function. post-traumatic stress disorder. Often, a soldier will receive injuries that cause both together, and the symptoms can be confounded and very difficult to sort out and treat. Also, depression, as I also mentioned, high rates of suicide. And then because of other wounds, traditional wounds of war, shrapnel wounds, bullet wounds, chronic pain, and then again, substance use disorders. We owe it to these soldiers to take care of them in a much better way than we now know how to do when they return from protecting us all. And then despite this need, which is extraordinary, and for those of you, you know, there are probably people from the pharmaceutical industry here from who work on brain disorders, on the central nervous system. So this is what they're always telling their big bosses. But despite enormous unmet need, and with that, enormous markets, industry is disinvesting. Not all companies, not perhaps the companies here, but many companies from brain disorders as too difficult. And one of the, just one example is if you look at even after phase one, first in man administration of a compound, CNS has a very, very high failure rate, meaning it does not show up ultimately in a pill bottle at CVS. Or being lost in the mail by Medco. It is, it has a very, very high failure rate. And part of this reflects something we together have to fix, right? There's a shortage of validated molecular targets in especially for neuropsychiatric disorders, but for many also of the traditional neurologic disorders. Animal models are not great in any part of medicine, but they often don't predict efficacy, and we have to think about better models, perhaps using, not to get too technical in this talk, highly penetrant genetic mutations instead of low penetrant SNPs. We have to think about using stem cells. We have still a few biomarkers, but some interesting consortia across government, industry, academia have been forming. And their success, for example, in Alzheimer's disease. And many of you have read about this recently in the popular press, or where I read these things now in the Journal of the New York Times. We provost, you know, it's mostly read memos, actually. And the other thing we shouldn't forget is that the brain is inaccessible, right, behind its skull. Which is a real challenge for treatment development. It's not like cancer where a surgeon can literally take out the offending tissue and you can study it. And then for many disorders such as pain or neuropsychiatric disorders, the endpoints in clinical trials are subjective, which again makes it very, very difficult to succeed in clinical trials. Okay, so here is the case that we, I think, need to make. We have to, you know, it's palpably true that progress has been slow to this point because it's hard, right? The brain is the most complex organ that human science has ever undertaken to investigate. Nonetheless, the burden of disease that I quickly passed over, including the issues affecting our veterans, makes progress urgent, like no excuses. So the question then is, okay, I get it that it's urgent, but if it's been so hard, what is different? Why are you going to succeed now? And I think most of the people in this room are here to illustrate that situation. Why now? And I can't wait to hear everybody's talks about this. But among other things, there really are new tools that you're going to hear about. And again, you'll read it in the booklet. You know, we like to think science makes progress only through our ideas, but tools matter. You know, without the telescope, Galileo would not have had to be excommunicated. I mean, wouldn't have discovered the four moons, Galilean moons of Jupiter, and reorganized our understanding of the universe. And we really have very important new tools. And I don't only mean things that come in a kit. I mean large platforms that produce important data, whether it's genomics or genetics or epigenetic screens or forms of microscopy or forms of non-invasive imaging that require not only pieces of equipment but large teams of people. We have certainly have many new ideas which will be covered in the coming 2 days, and also, as Garen suggested, new forms of organization. And these changes, which are real and which we're going to document, are the reason we can now recommit ourselves to a big push in the brain sciences. So the challenges I've already told you, the brain is the most complex organ. You know, it's got thousands of distinct cell types. It's an easy competition if you have an argument with a hepatologist, right? They only have two or three cell types. The brain expresses in aggregate about 80% of the genome, but what does express mean? That's only the beginning, right? I mean, it then creates unbelievable diversity downstream of RNA polymerase acting. We have an additional level of analysis compared to most other organ systems, which is the systems level, right? We have to think about molecules and cells and synapses, but also small and large-scale circuits. And again, they're exciting new tools. We'll hear about optogenetics as one. We'll hear from some of the brain imagers as others, as a way of beginning to understand the circuitry and correlated very specifically on the one hand with certain cells and on the other hand with certain behaviors or cognitive states. And for those of you who are not neuroscientists, here are just a few classic drawings of the different cell types. There literally are thousands. And over here, the Purkinje cell of the cerebellum, for those of you who are not neuroscientists, may make several hundred thousand individual connections or synapses with other neurons. So overall in the brain, there are more than 100 trillion of these synapses, and they're not static, right? Because of brain plasticity, the way we change in response to development, experience, the way we learn, these synapses are changing all the time, and we're beginning to understand the detailed molecular mechanisms of that. I've mentioned the other challenge we have to overcome, which is that the brain is not readily accessible. It's behind an opaque, bony skull. I won't discuss both the ethical and practical problem of getting tissues, but just compare it to cancer biology. And again, it's not that cancer biology is easy, but a surgeon goes, takes a tumor, you can take that tissue, you can put it on the chip of your choice. There's now a project to understand every somatic mutation in 20 common cancers. It's very hard. You have to figure out what are the driver mutations, what are the passengers, but you know, in the end, we can't do that. And we can't do that not only for ethical reasons, but we can't do that because so many of our diseases are due to the interaction of within circuits of neurons that have begun in different brain regions and different cell types, and it's just not that simple. So another problem for us to overcome. I'm not going to belabor these slides because the argument is that we are making progress. So the new tools that we're going to hear highlighted today are go beyond this list, but we're going to hear about progress in genomics, which is the global study of genomes, and genetics, which is the correlation of genetic variation with phenotypic traits, including disease, that we care about. We're going to hear about exciting new studies in gene regulation, including epigenetics, which are ways of marking either DNA or the histone proteins that control them to produce relatively long-term changes in the way genes are activated or deactivated in the brain, both by developmental processes, but in an exciting way, by lived experience. We're going to hear about stem cells as disease models, and we're going to hear more broadly about regenerative biology. Now, we often think of stem cells potentially as cell therapies that might replace lost neurons, for example, in Parkinson's disease, but maybe an earlier use will be the ability to take say, a skin cell of somebody who genetically has the propensity to have a certain disease, we know because they have the disease, and differentiate those into the right kind of neurons, and then use those potentially to screen for new drug therapies, something that is very, very important. And of course, there is progress, hard won, given, again, the inaccessibility of the brain in human experimental neurobiology through such methods as cognitive neuroscience and imaging, and also, very excitingly, both for learning and for therapy, brain-machine interfaces. So I want to make up a bit of time. These pictures are all, I was going to advertise the pamphlet you have, but the pictures are in the pamphlet. Let me just end with saying two things. One of the things we have to do to save the ecosystem moving from basic discovery to treatment is to help our industry brethren de-risk treatment development so that they can convince their shareholders that this is a worthwhile thing to do. And I think what the goal of the academic community is to identify targets, as we have been doing. But you know, our community has been a little undisciplined because we're so hungry to find targets. We've been a little bit undisciplined about target validation. We need to work hard to develop better animal models, to learn to use chemical screens, to work together to develop biomarkers, and to do better phenotyping. And in so doing, we absolutely have to collaborate across sectors, including with industry. And as Garen implied, we have to think about the ways in which IP increases progress by enhancing the motives to develop something, but also the ways in which IP hampers progress when some of us get a bit too excited and patent basic research tools. So this healthy, sustained ecosystem for all of us is going to require strong basic science, open innovation models, having just talked about that, funding for tool building, technology platforms, and databases, and the cost of sharing those, and rich connections among academia, government, biotech, and the pharmaceutical industry. Over the next 2 days, we will share amongst ourselves as scientists and with policymakers and other leaders of science in the United States, the sense that we feel the urgency, but based on the kinds of changes that that we will all show with our work, we will prove that it really is time to make a big push in brain sciences. Thank you very much.